Some great ideas have really propelled the world forward, and we often think that those ideas emerge from eureka moments. A person thinking about a problem figured out a solution suddenly and decisively. Our guest this hour disabuses us of the concept of the eureka moment. Even if the apple hit Newton in the head, he had studied physics for years before that moment. Alan Gannett is the author of The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. Alan Gannett is a big believer in creativity and in the use of data. He's the founder and CEO of the marketing analytics company TrackMaven, which helps other companies use data to drive creativity. Not to drop names, but the clients range from the likes of General Electric to Saks Fifth Avenue. Alan Gannett, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So what got you interested in data-driven creativity in the first place?
I think I've always been a tinkerer. You know, I was the only child of heavily divorced parents. You know, they were divorced when I was like one, and so I had a lot of time by myself. And I think I always was just into reverse engineering things. And, you know, as I sort of looked at my career and as I looked at the marketers we worked with and the creators we worked with, I saw that a lot of people had this notion that creativity is this magical, mystical thing. And the reality is that we actually have a lot of science around creativity. We actually know a ton about how creativity works.
So the way in which you use the term creativity intrigues me right up front. I mean, is the kind of creativity that produces a great work of art the same as that which produces a successful commercial product?
Yeah, so there's two types of creativity that academics refer to. So they call it lowercase c creativity and uppercase c creativity. So lowercase c creativity is just creating something new. Uppercase c creativity, that's actually the type of creativity most of us want to do. That's creating something that's both new and valuable. New and valuable. And the value part is interesting because value is subjective, right? For something to be valuable, we have to agree it's valuable. And the result is that what you find are the things that are deemed creative in our culture and our history are things that a group of people, big or small, have deemed to be creative. So the result is that, sure, you know, a piece of fine art that a bunch of art critics have agreed is creative, but also a mainstream pop hit is definitely creative. And you see this over time where a lot of the things that we look back and say, wow, well, the Beatles were so creative. Well, the Beatles at the time were pop musicians.
That is true. That is true. They were commercially successful as well. And one led to the other. And the big question, I guess, is in which direction?
Yeah, and this is one of the things that's so interesting about creativity is that, you know, so often when we think about creativity, I think we think about the writer who is, you know, cooped up in the writing cabin somewhere writing their next great American novel. But it actually turns out that since creativity has this whole social construct element to it, that the most successful creative achievers are actually the ones who are also good at selling it, promoting it, or finding the people who can help them with that side of the equation.
I guess where this really gets intriguing in the book is when you talk about, and to return to the concept of fine art that you were talking about, like paintings. Before the Renaissance, there really wasn't much of a market for art. But when you began to have wealthy patrons who were thinking, you know, I need some art to hang on my walls, that's what really developed this market in which then people could make great sales because they were making great paintings.
Yeah, I mean, capitalism and creativity have been intertwined for now thousands of years where, you know, originally society viewed creatives as basically, or artists as mere craftspeople. They were just, you know, people who would create the paintings in churches that were necessary, but they weren't viewed as special. And literally what happened is in Western culture during the Italian Renaissance, when there was this huge new market for art among merchants who wanted to live like kings and have these decorated houses and all this, you know, there was just more demand than supply. And so the artists who were out there began, you know, building up their prices. They started viewing themselves as special because they were becoming rich. They started demanding that their patrons view them as special. And the idea of the famous artist really came about because of that, you know, economic boom.
So genius, even if it's genius, needs to have some appreciators.
Exactly. And that's where, you know, there becomes this sort of circular aspect of creativity that I think is so interesting is that, you know, if I was to today paint Jackson Pollock, you know, you might say, well, Alan is skilled in replication. He might have some technical skills, but he's not creative. And so there's this whole element to creativity around timing and how people view it and how people appreciate or don't appreciate it that is almost more important than the actual art of creation. I mean, Andy Warhol famously didn't actually create a lot of his art. He would call into the factory and dictate how he wanted the screen print to look. But yet, On the other side, we definitely view him as a creative. And so there's this differentiation between the production of creative work and it actually being deemed creative.
Ah, that's an interesting point, too, to consider that if Jackson Pollock did it, it's a great Jackson Pollock. But if somebody else did it, so what? It's a forgery.
Exactly.
Are some geniuses born, or do even the geniuses that we acknowledge have to put in plenty of work, too?
So this is really interesting. You know, when I started working on the book, I definitely had this notion that creativity could be learned and developed. But for the book, what I did is the first half of the book is debunking this inspiration theory of creativity. And to do this, I interviewed all the leading academics across the fields of creativity, the study of greatness, talent development, all the different aspects of academia that look at creativity. The second half of the book, I interviewed about 25 living creative geniuses. So these are billionaires like David Rubenstein, you know, Pasek and Paul, the songwriting duo behind Dear Evan Hansen, the lyrics of La La Land, Greatest Showman, you know, Brenda Chapman, the first woman to win the Academy Award for Best Animated Film, et cetera, et cetera. And what was so interesting from the interviews of the academics and reading all this peer-reviewed research is that actually researchers have a very strong consensus that the idea of natural-born talent is maybe at best overblown, but most likely a myth. In fact, when you look at most cases of natural-born talent and you go back in time, what you often find is some sort of misattribution. So, you know, maybe there's a young girl who goes to her first ever track practice at age 12 and she's an amazing runner, but you actually find from age 5 she was playing baseball in the backyard with her dad and she was running between the bases, and without even realizing it, she was practicing sprinting from a very, very young age. And so the idea of natural-born talent, most academics would say, is it's probably not actually true.
All right, so we'll come back and talk about the Isaac Newton example and all the things that went on before the apple hit his head, if the apple hit his head. The book is called The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. It's the work of Alan Gannett, our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Alan and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about creativity and genius and how those things all mesh together. It's not necessarily what you invent, it's about when in time you invent it. And so the book is called The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. It's the work of Alan Gannett, who is the founder and CEO of marketing analytics company TrackMaven. He's a big believer in creativity and the use of data. You can join us on The Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the previous example was the girl who starts running track for the first time at age 12, and it just looks like she's loaded with talent, when it turns out she was spending years running around playing baseball with her father. So likewise, in the example of Isaac Newton getting hit in the head with the apple, how much training had he done before any of the apocryphal apple story happened?
Yeah, I mean, Newton's a great example. I mean, he'd been doing years of studying physics. He was an avid learner and student. Mozart's another great example where, you know, we think of Mozart as popping out of the womb playing piano. But the reality is when he was 3 years old, he had what essentially we would today call a helicopter dad. And his helicopter dad said that you need to become a great musician. And he hired him some of the best music teachers in all of Europe and made this little kid practice 3 hours every single day from the age of 3. So, yeah, in his 20s, he was pretty good. But at that point, you know, he'd been practicing over 17 years of 3 hours a day with the best music teachers in all of Europe under the conditional love of a helicopter dad. I mean, you'd be pretty good, too.
Steve Jobs, as you point out in the book, says creative people just saw something. Are we talking about patterns? Is that the kind of thinking he means?
So what's so interesting about creativity is that one of the reasons why people think it's so magical is that we have these aha moments where suddenly, in a second, something becomes clear. And we ascribe this to some sort of higher power or, you know, some muse, whatever your belief system is. And the issue with this is that it's a great example of us, you know, sort of taking a very simple explanation to something we can't easily explain, when in the reality, science actually has a really good understanding of these aha moments, and it just turns out they're biology. So it's kind of cliche to talk about left brain, right brain when you talk about creativity, but it's actually pretty important, basically these aha moments happen in the right hemisphere of your brain. So in your left hemisphere is where you do very logical processing. It's where you're solving a math problem. And this type of information processing and this type of problem solving, it's very conscious. When you're doing long division, you're aware of every step along the way. I like to think about it as, you know, think about in college, you had that loud lab partner who would sort of say, okay, let's do this, and then this, and then this, and we got the answer. But then your right hemisphere, it also solves problems, but it does it by connecting more distant ideas together. It solves it by doing metaphors, by finding related concepts in places you might not realize. It's where when you hear a stand-up comedian, it's why you instantly get why a joke is funny, assuming the comedian's funny, but it's why you instantly get why the joke's funny without having to think about it step by step. And this type of processing, it turns out, all happens subconsciously. It's like the quiet lab partner. They're sitting there working by themselves, and only once they actually get the answer do they sort of chirp up and say, hey, I got the answer. But the problem is that so often we're so busy in our lives where, you know, we're doing all these things that we don't actually hear, so to speak, our right hemisphere. And this is why you tend to experience aha moments in the shower or on your commute or when you're running. It's not that those things are inspiring. It's that your left hemisphere is quiet. You can actually hear what's been percolating in your right hemisphere. And so these things that we think of as magical or divine are really just one way that our brain happens to process information. They're not special. They're just subconscious.
Are the people then who we tend to regard as geniuses or great discoverers or creators, are they people who are good at synthesis, who can take the different parts of things together and go, oh, this, why don't we put these together and see what happens?
So one of the things I found that's so interesting in my research was that, you know, one of the things that scientists really harp on when it comes to aha moments, and there's professors and academics who just studied aha moments. There's Northwestern has a creative brain lab, which does all sorts of interesting work. What's interesting is that one of the essential things to have aha moments is to have prior knowledge. And, you know, the issue is that for a lot of us, we haven't done the consumption necessary to give us the dots to connect. You know, Paul McCartney famously woke up from a dream with the melody for Yesterday in his head. The reality is he woke up with six notes for the song, and this was after years and years of playing in a cover band, being surrounded by musical parents and musical upbringing. You know, J.K. Rowling dreamed up the characters for Harry Potter, but this was after years and years of being an avid book reader. You know, she would lock herself in her bedroom when she was a kid to get away from her parents fighting, to just read books and books and books. In college, she had library finds because she had so many books out. And so what you find is that oftentimes these best creators are also some of the biggest consumers of their sort of creative product's niche. You know, they have read every book, they've watched every movie, and the result is that their right hemisphere has all these different ideas, and there's this rich sort of ingredient base for which it can connect new ideas and synthesize things. And so it's not necessarily that they're more quote-unquote talented at something, it's just they have more to work with.
Alan Gannett, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. And Alan, one thing you add to the Paul McCartney and Yesterday story, and everybody's heard the story about, you know, he had this melody, kept singing scrambled eggs because he didn't have Yesterday yet. But you point out what a lot of other people haven't pointed out, which was how long he mulled over this song before scrambled eggs became Yesterday.
Oh, I mean, yeah, it was a 20-month process to finish the song Yesterday. And, you know, we think of it as this, you know, instantaneous moment, you know, similar to the J.K. Rowling story. We've all heard the story of her being on the train and being hit with this idea, but she then spent 5 years finishing the first book. There's an interview with her where she shows the TV interviewer a box of the 15 different versions of chapter one she had written for the first book. I mean, this is not the story of a very linear process of going from, you know, a sudden insight to, boom, you know, billionaire. The result is actually the result of an incredible amount of hard, iterative work.
Well, and then Ray Charles actually gets a cameo in Paul McCartney's creative process, among others. Why him?
So what you see is that you actually, when you look at the melody for Yesterday, it actually is very, very similar to the notes, the note patterns in George on My Mind, the Ray Charles version. And so and Paul McCartney and John Lennon, you know, were huge, huge Ray Charles fans. He was one of the musicians they did lots of covers of. And, you know, when you actually start to take a look and you start to think about creativity more generally, what you start to realize is that really all creative products are to some degree a remix. There really isn't anything that's entirely new. In fact, as humans, we wouldn't like things that are radically new. There's these two underlying mechanisms that scientists have found drive human preference. And they're really interesting because they seem like a contradiction. On one side, we crave things that are novel. They represent potential sources of reward. You know, if we were a hunter-gatherer and we saw a new berry in a field, we'd be excited. It could be a new source of dinner. But then we also have this other urge. We also have this aversion, this fear of the unfamiliar, because we're scared that we might get hurt, right? If you were a cave dweller and you saw a cave you've never slept in before versus a cave you've slept in multiple times, you'd go for the one you've slept in before. And there's something that feels safe about the familiar. And these two urges, the pursuit of novelty and the fear of the unfamiliar, they seem like contradictions of each other. But it's actually our brain's really elegant way of balancing risk and reward. It turns out that the things we like are things that are a balance of the familiar with a twist of novelty. They're familiar enough to feel safe. They're novel enough to intrigue us. And so what you find is that the best creative products are a blend of these two things, right? The first Star Wars was a Western in space. A lot of music these days involves samples of other music. Right now, there's that sushi burrito trend that's blowing up. That's these giant sushi rolls. It's familiar, but it's novel. And so what you find is that the best creatives are actually not just about creating things that are new, but creating things that are the right type of new.
So this is interesting because I've often derided the market research concept, which I know you're heavily involved in, with finding out what people want. But the fact is that that's the zone in which you can find something new that people will like, though, as opposed to going way outside that zone, taking a guess on something, and it just blows up.
Yeah, and this is why you see that the biggest creative achievers are actually often very data and feedback obsessed, because they realize that such a big part of capital C creativity is that social contract with the audience. It is getting appreciated. It is getting recognition. It is actually getting people to pay attention. And so since that's a part of it, and since that involves getting to that optimal zone of familiarity and novelty, getting feedback from your audience early and often, doesn't have to be high tech, can be literally just asking people, is essential to nailing the creative process. Because you as a creator are going to have a different perception of what's familiar and novel than your audience is going to have.
Alan Gannett's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the founder and CEO of a marketing analytics company called TrackMaven. And he's written a book called The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. And we're exploring the things that we often give people credit for being geniuses about, when in fact they have put in a whole lot of hard work for a very long time. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a little personal dogleg here, because you spent some time on game shows, Anderson. You studied to get ready for Wheel of Fortune?
So I wish I had studied to get ready for the actual game, because I ended up losing to Joan from Alexandria, who won $60,000 in a car, but it's not a sore subject. I did study, however, though, to get on the show. And so I had this, I've always been a big fan of reverse engineering things. And when I was 18, I had this phase where I was like, how hard can it be to get on a game show? And so I applied to all of them, and I got called back to do an audition for Wheel of Fortune, having never watched the show before. And so I watched dozens and dozens of episodes. I read all sorts of online posts about people's audition experiences. And I realized they weren't really looking for if you could solve the puzzles. Like, they didn't care. What they cared about was, could you enunciate? Were you energetic? And would you sort of make a fool of yourself? And I was like, I can do all three of those things. And so the day that came for the actual audition, I drank a lot of coffee. I enunciated very clearly. And I did an Elmo impression. And they were like, and you're on the show. And so I had a little bit of, I was like, okay, this is cool. I lost. But then I thought, I wonder if this would work again. And so I actually did it again and auditioned for another game show. This was an MTV show hosted by Nick Cannon. I got on that one too. And so that was one of my dorkier experiences with pattern recognition.
But so did you have any more success on the MTV show than you had on
No,
here?
I lost again.
Wow.
All right. You bring up all the sore subjects on this interview today.
Sorry, and I didn't mean to put these next to each other, but you do acknowledge the theory about creative people, that they can be mentally unstable or have been known to be that way in parts of history.
So, you know, it's definitely a sort of a story that's out there, but the science tells us that when you actually look at it and you control for things like economics, you find that these, you know, creative masters actually aren't more depressed or suicidal or any of these things. It just so happens that, you know, if you're a writer, you're more likely to be poor, and poor people are more likely to encounter depression. And so what you find is that there's actually quite a bit of hype in these stories around the sort of neurotic creative genius. And there's a really famous study done by Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, where he took a bunch of art school students and he surveyed them, he did interviews with them, and what he found is that the students who performed the best in art school and were recognized by their peers as the best artists were the ones who fit the sort of like mold of an artist. They were sort of weird and dark and odd and maybe depressed, and they were just, they had this artist vibe to them. 10 years later, he followed up with these students. He found that none of those students, the ones who did well in art school, none of them had become successful. The ones who become really successful were actually the artists who were best at promoting themselves. They had salesmanship skills, marketing skills. And so what you find when you actually look at the research around creativity is that it actually turns out that there's a lot of learnable and nurturable skills that actually are the most correlated to creative success.
So who you are matters somewhat to the recognition of what you produce?
So there is a piece of that, but it's actually, I'd say more, it's about who you know or who you're able to get connected to. And so this is why you see the effect that sociologists call clustering, where you see these creative communities have a lot of density in certain places, is because since there's this whole social construct and social phenomenon, it's very important for you to be near other people who can lend you their reputation, who can lend you their credibility, who can teach you new skills and new tactics and new techniques. And so you find this in almost every creative industry. You see, you know, country musicians will, you know, move to Nashville, and then they'll happen to become friends with another more famous country musician who will let them open on tour. And then, you know, lo and behold, they become more famous. You know, Rascal Flatts once had this teenager named Taylor Swift open for them, and now you look where she's become. And so since there's this whole social construct, it's really, really important to be near, to be proximate to other people.
We are talking to Alan Gannett, the author of The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time, not just ideas, but also when in history they come out. So one of the things that I was just sort of anticipating you to get to in the book, and you do in fact get there, is this 10,000-hour rule, and I wonder what you make of that.
Oh, my God, you're making me shudder already. So the 10,000-hour rule has become this sort of you know, dirty phrase for people who are serious in talent development and the academics and the researchers there. Because basically it's based on, so the 10,000-hour rule was popularized by Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers, and it's this idea that with 10,000 hours of practice, you can become world-class at anything. And it's based on research by K. Anders Ericsson, who's a famous professor in the field of talent development. And I interviewed him for my book, and he gave me this quote, which is in the book, which is, quote, Gladwell misread my paper, period, unquote. And that says a lot, but basically, you know, there's two big problems with the 10,000-hour rule. First is that Anders Ericsson did not find that it was 10,000 hours. He found that that was the average across skills and across people. You know, certain skills, like becoming a world-class piano player, because people have been doing it for longer, there's more people doing it. These days it takes about 25,000 hours to become world-class at. But on the other hand, there's now all these tournaments around digit memorization, like how many digits of pi you can memorize. And you can become world-class at digit memorization about 400 hours because less people have been doing it. There's less people trying right now. It's been around for less time. And so the actual activity is important. Also, different people take different amounts of time. But the second issue with it, this is actually the bigger issue. The second issue with it is that nowhere in Gladwell's book does it mention the word deliberate. And Anders Ericsson's research is all about a specific type of practice called deliberate practice. And the difference is that practice is just, you know, doing something in repetition over and over again. It's playing a game of basketball. Deliberate practice is breaking down a skill into tiny little micro skills where you can keep conscious about that skill. In basketball, it'd be mid-court left-handed dribbling. If you wanted to become a NASCAR driver, you wouldn't just keep driving. You know, we've all done that. You would practice high-speed, you know, left turns and do that over and over and over again. And so deliberate practice, it turns out, is actually the thing that's correlated with creative achievement. It's not hours of practice, actually. And so that's actually a hugely important distinction that Gladwell glosses over.
So you can't sit at the piano and play Mary Had a Little Lamb for 10,000 hours and expect to play the Rachmaninoff 3, for example. You really have to go beyond the plateau.
Exactly. There's actually a study done by Erickson where he actually looks at music school students, and he found that talent, quote-unquote, was correlated to the number of hours of deliberate practice, not the number of hours of practice.
All right, so deliberate practice, again, working on specific skills. And, you know, this is interesting when you bring up driving. You brought up NASCAR drivers, but after the age of, what, 20 maybe, we don't really try to improve our own driving on the streets, and we could.
Yeah, you could. It said our brain is very good at making skills automatic. It's trying to constantly make things subconscious, but the only way to keep learning is to keep it conscious, which you can only do by breaking down the skill into little parts. You can keep thinking about that.
I advise people to learn to use their turn signals a lot, but that's a different story. Alan Gannett's our guest. His book is The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. We'll come back and talk more with him. And if you'd like to join us, we will take phone calls and emails from you. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. We're talking about those eureka moments that may or may not, in fact, exist when people have this great discovery, this great idea for something and give it to the rest of the world, and everybody thinks that person's a genius. Well, the eureka moments are usually preceded by many, many years of careful study and practice, as pointed out by Alan Gannett in his book, The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. The good news for the rest of us is that with a lot of practice, we can be considered geniuses, too, depending on the circumstances. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about driving skills and the fact that people actually don't tend to work to improve those after a certain age, but you certainly can, which brings us to another area, the taxi drivers and the growth of the hippocampus. This is a really interesting part of the book.
Yeah, so one of the problems we have with how we perceive things is we tend to be really bad at sort of thinking that things we can't see have logic to them. Things we can't see, for whatever reason, we just assume they're either static, they can't change, or maybe isn't an explanation. So a great example is, you know, if I start going to the gym and eating lots of skinless, boneless chicken, I would gain muscle mass. We all sort of agree with that notion. But for some reason, we think our brain is just this static thing. And there's actually all this fascinating research around neurogenesis, neuroplasticity, around the fact that our brain actually generates thousands of new brain cells every day. And much like how our muscles adapt, these new brain cells actually go to the part of your brain which is most active, and they sort of help out. They make that part of the brain stronger, so to speak. And so there's one example study of this where they looked at taxi cab drivers, and they put them in MRI machines. And what they found is that the part of the hippocampus that was tied to visual, spatial, navigational skills actually got bigger the longer they had been cab drivers. The skill they were doing, their brain adapted to it. And so this is one of the big sort of myths that people struggle with when it comes to thinking that they can or cannot develop talent, is they think that they have these fixed assets, that, you know, you have to keep looking for things, and eventually you'll find something that, you know, is easy for you, that you're passionate at. And the problem is that most people who are talented at something just start very young, and they had the hard part, but their parents forced them through it. And so your brain does adapt to these things in, like, amazing ways, and we can't see it.
That's a section in the book on talent. There's a section just after it about genius, and this is where we get to Darwin and Wallace and evolution. And so what do we learn about creativity and genius from their situation?
So this is you know, we've all obviously heard about Darwin and evolution and all this stuff, but one of the things that, you know, isn't well told is the story of Alfred Wallace, who he actually discovered natural selection before Darwin ever published a paper. And he, you know, did all these findings and found the same phenomenon. And he had been sort of professional acquaintances with Darwin. And so he sent Darwin a letter describing what he had discovered. Darwin had been working on a similar theory, natural selection. And he got this letter and he was sort of in shock. And he quickly emailed, wrote to, sorry about that. He wrote to one of his friends in the scientific community and said, hey, what should we do? And his friend said, well, why don't we publish a letter from both of you describing this? And so they published this letter without asking Wallace, describing this and giving both of them credit. But what you find is that today, all we talk about is Darwin. It's Darwin's theory. And the reason why was that at the time, Darwin was more well-known, he was more well-respected, he was better connected. Wallace actually stayed out to sea and kept up his voyages while Darwin was promoting this theory and getting his name out there. And in fact, when Wallace came back and finally wrote his own book on the topic, at that point, he actually called the theory of evolution Darwinism in deference to Darwin. And so what you find is that, you know, we think of Darwin as this, you know, creative genius, this historical figure, but actually a lot of that has to do with timing around how he was viewed at the time, how he was viewed in history books, what his legacy was. And that is not actually just based on, you know, what he discovered, but also how he communicated it.
Well, two things about timing here. One is the recurrence of what you point out is called simultaneous invention. And it seems that the quest for such invention must be in the culture or the zeitgeist of the time.
Yeah, I mean, you see this over and over. I mean, Edison, you know, someone else tried to patent the light bulb the same year. The telephone, it was the same day. But yet, you know, Alexander Graham Bell, that's who we think of when we think of the telephone. And so you have this whole side of invention and creativity that has to do with recognition. And, you know, it's important to recognize that if you really want to achieve things in a creative career.
So it's not just the fact that a lot of people think about things in the same time, but also the time in history is important because, as you suggest in the book, Darwin in 1559 might have had a problem.
Exactly. You don't want to be burned at the stake, right? So, you know, you might have a great idea, but it has to be presented in the right way at the right time to the right people. And, you know, Darwinism is actually a really great example because actually there were some Roman philosophers who wrote about things that were quite similar to the eventual theory of natural selection, but they didn't really get the appreciation that, you know, Darwin got with his ideas much later.
So this brings us to the heart of the book, the creative curve. It's a bell-shaped curve showing what, Alan?
So what scientists have found is both at the individual level and the group level, there's this relationship. When you map out the relationship between familiarity with something and human preference for it, there's an upside-down U shape. And they call it the inverted U relationship between familiarity and preference. I'm a marketer. I thought that was a terrible name, so I rebranded it the creative curve. Could be an alternate title for the book. And basically what you find is that when you're first exposed to something, you don't really like it that much. It's too new. Then the more you're exposed to it, you start to like it more and more because you're in that sweet spot of familiarity and novelty, so you get rising interest. Then eventually, ideas reach this point of cliche where our novelty seeking wins out and we start wanting new things. And then the more we're exposed to something, the less we like it. And the result is you get this upside down U shape, this inverted U relationship, which I call the creative curve. And using that as a framework is incredibly important for creatives because really your job is very relatively straightforward. It's how do you create ideas that are on the left side of the creative curve that are that right blend of familiarity and novelty, where with some additional exposure, you will quickly rise in preference and rise in interest.
Is this incrementalism, though? I mean, are you essentially just taking stuff that's out there and adding a little more to it or changing the melody, the harmony, so, you know, the color, the texture, something?
I think, you know, I would push back on the premise. You know, incrementalism, I don't think is a bad thing. I think when you look at all creative works, everything is derivative of each other. You know, I hate quoting Kanye West, but he tweeted out the other day that, you know, great artists steal an update. And I think it's so true. I mean, you look at, you know, the great musicians and the great painters of our times, and they were constantly borrowing techniques and ideas from other people. And the idea of something being completely new is literally impossible, right? Unless you raise a child in a vacuum where they can never be exposed to any other creative work. And you probably wouldn't like the output. It would be too new. It would be too scary.
Well, there has to be context. I mean, it has to be something relative to what you already know. If you bring in, you know, a work of art or music from another planet, people are going, what is this?
Exactly. And this is why the timing element of creativity is so, so important, is that people are judging creative products against the creative products they've already seen or experienced.
Here's a call from Ryan in Eugene. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Alan Gannett, the author of The Creative Curve.
Well, I'm sorry I jumped in late on this conversation. This is really fascinating. And, you know, I think about my own history of starting off as a biologist, then a biologist, think, you know, focused on genetics, and I then focused on, you know, biochemical genetics, and then finally ended it my career as a neuroendocrinologist. You know, these synergies. But my question really is around the sense of identity and, you know, science and math. As an educator, I run into youth who look across the room and say, well, it's just easy for him. And there's that, and it becomes a blockage. And there's actually some theories about, you know, about skills and attitudes, you know, being somewhat intrinsic. And I think it really hurts people because they don't understand the 10,000 hours or whatever the euphemism is that person who looks like it's easy for them has invested at that point. And they think it's intrinsic. They think it's genetic. And it really hurts us.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I'm in violent agreement. I mean, I think it's very scary to me what happens in our school systems these days. I mean, there were some studies in the 90s that found that 86% of kindergartners tested at creative genius levels of creative potential. But by the time they're in high school, it's in the teens in terms of percents, in terms of what percent tested that level. And so what you see is that, you know, in school, we push people to specialize, but, you know, oftentimes we do that way too fast, way too quickly, without enough exposure to different things. And you see this with so many kids come out of high school thinking that, okay, like, you know, I'm just going to be a blank and I can't be that thing. And the reality is, the science shows us you can be that. And so I do think there is a huge problem right now in the education system that hasn't been solved yet.
Does it come necessarily just from the education system, though? Because it seems like, you know, lots of times you'll hear somebody say, "Oh, you're so lucky. You're such a brain, or you're just a genius," you know. And the problem from the person saying those things is to think I could never be that, and that's not necessarily true.
Correct. And I actually think there's also an element. There's two sides of it. I think there's a discouraging side, but I also think we sometimes use that as a subtle excuse to ourselves, right? I think we sometimes know it's a lot of work, but we say, oh, well, like, I'm waiting to find my passion. And that might be code word for I'm waiting to find something that's easy for me. With this idea being that there's something easy out there, that for some people these things are easy. But again, J.K. Rowling took 5 years to write her first book. Nothing's easy. It just looks easy. And so I think we have to change our mindsets when it comes to creativity and realize and acknowledge that no matter what, it's going to be difficult. And even those people who make it look effortless, at one point, it was a lot of effort.
So this brings us back to a section of the book about education and IQ tests, the Stanford-Binet IQ test, much maligned over the years, and Lewis Terman and his use of it. What did he add to the thinking about IQ and genius?
So Lewis Terman Americanized the IQ test. He was a professor at Stanford, and he unfortunately used it for all sorts of dark ways and, you know, propagated a lot of eugenics ideas. But one of the ways he also wanted to use the IQ test was to prove that geniuses were normal. See, in the late 1800s, there was all this mad genius literature that had come out, and geniuses had developed this very negative reputation. And so his whole idea was, let's take thousands of kids and let's test them, and let's find the ones with genius-level IQs, and let's start following their lives, and we'll send them surveys every 5 years. And so he did these tests, and he found 2,000 kids with genius-level IQs and started sending them surveys. He actually called these kids termites, which is the worst branding of all time.
Okay.
And he, even after he died, his proteges kept sending them these surveys. And what they found was that these kids, well, they were normal when it came to divorce, depression, suicide, all these things. But they were also incredibly normal when it came to success. They, you know, there were shopkeepers, maintenance men. There actually were no kids in that group who went on to become household names or win Nobel Prizes. In fact, the only two kids that he tested that went on to win a Nobel Prize were two kids who didn't make the cut. And so what you find is that IQ is actually measuring a very, very narrow slice of cognitive ability that doesn't represent the totality of someone's ability. And I think that's one of the dangerous things that we come to, is we think that, you know, you have to be an IQ genius to be a creative genius, and you don't.
Does IQ measure anything like, intuition, or you know, does it measure creativity in any way?
Well, there's a theory called the threshold theory, which is that basically above a relatively average IQ, an IQ of 104, we all have the same creative potential. So once you get to that, you know, it's a few billion people on the planet, IQ doesn't really matter. What matters actually are learnable, nurturable skills like openness, for example.
Huh. So in your work then, Alan, and using, you know, believing in creativity and also believing in big data, I mean, can you collect enough information that you can account for variabilities in societal tastes, you know, in timing in history, in sort of the mood of the public that might be accepting a product or a service that you're trying to help somebody market? And I mean, can you, with some level of reliability, know exactly what the right release point of a certain product is?
So I think you can get yourself into the right zone. I think that's the thing to remember. It's that I don't think there's a way to 100% nail it every time, but I think you can get very, very close, and especially a lot closer than you are. In the book, I talk about the day I spent with the Ben & Jerry's flavor development team, which was a whole fun experience. Mm-hmm. And you know, they would go, and every year they come up with a list of 200 flavor ideas. And you know, they're very talented. They've been doing this for a long time. But their immediate reaction is to go and do an email survey where they ask customers two questions about each flavor idea. One, how unique is it? And two, how likely are you to buy? Or, better said, how familiar is it and how novel is it? Because they realize that they have to balance those two things. If they just ask people what are they likely to buy, they'll end up with all cookies and caramel and chocolate flavors. If they just ask people what's unique, they'll just get weirdness and no one will buy it. So it's about balancing those two things, and data can help.
All right, those are the two big words I've scratched on my sheet, novel and familiar. They have to be in balance. Alan Gannett is the author of The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. Thank you so much for joining us today.